interview with C.G. Gomillion, G-O-M-I-L-L-I-O-N, veteran black political leader, Tuskegee, T-U-S-K-E-G-E-E, Alabama, July 11th, 1974.
I guess first I'd like to ask you just to give a little brief or summary of your own political background in Alabama, your own background. Are you a native of Alabama?
I came from the worst state in the Union and the worst county in that state.
Foley was hanging, what is it?
South Carolina, and Edgefield County. That was J. Strong Thurman and Pitchfork Ben Till.
Okay.
I'm born in the little town of Johnston. It's about 7 miles from Edgefield, the county seat of Edgefield. And I came to Alabama in 28 as an employee of the Institute, the high school department. And I've been here ever since. And at least officially, I've been on leave several times with the federal government and various projects. Retired in May 71. And in politics, I've simply worked in Macon County mainly, and primarily in the area of stimulating registration of voting among Negroes. When I started out in 1932, that is working in the community, there were only about 30 Negro voters at that time. So the time we worked outside of the classroom was mainly in the area of stimulating registration voting. That's about it.
What were the events that led up to the suit with your name on it?
Oh, 1957.
This is Gomillion versus Lightfoot.
Yeah. In 1957, the city officials, I think, discovered that at the rate Negroes were registering at that time, they would probably, by 1960, have a number of voters, number of persons registered to vote in excess of whites, and therefore would probably influence the municipal election in 1960. And so I think the officials urged Sam Englehart, who was a senator in Macon County, to introduce a bill gerrymandering the city in such a way that it would put outside of the city limits a majority of the Negro voters. And so when some of us heard that the bill had been introduced, we urged the city officials to urge the senator to withdraw the bill. And when we had no success there, we appealed to the merchants. And nobody paid any attention to us, or nobody helped us. And so we began to hold public meetings, and we announced that we would not support the merchants in town, and along we treat with our friends, and buy from those who would help us. And so we withdrew our support from the merchants in town. In the meantime, we were appealing to members of the legislature and to some of the elected officials, particularly the governor. We had no success anywhere along the line except from the governor, who said to us that he didn't know whether he would approve the bill if it ever reached him or not.
Governor Folsom.
Yeah, Jim Folsom. The bill passed both houses without a dissenting vote. Not all of the members voted, but nobody voted against the bill. So in 57, I think think it was June, I believe, the bill was passed by both houses and sent to the governor, but the governor didn't sign it. And we found ourselves outside of the city limits and about 3,500 Negro citizens.
So he didn't veto it, but
it
became law without his signature.
Was it the subject of a very spirited debate when it went through, or did it go through very quietly?
It went through quiet, I think it was. No, there wasn't much, wasn't any debate, I don't think at all, it amounted to anything. We then, we 12 of us, filed suit against the city officials and the state legislature, state officials. Because the gerrymandering, the way the city was gerrymandered, it was changed from a four-sided figure, a square, to a 26-sided figure. You've probably seen a picture of it. But it was gerrymandered in such a way that approximately 3,500 Negro citizens were put out of city limits, and about 400 of the 410 Negro voters. And we went into court. We lost in the district court, appealed to the Circuit Court of Appeals. We won there. The defendants then appealed to the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court sent it back to the district court to be tried on its merit. Judge Johnson stated that he thought he had enough evidence to rule without holding a trial. And so he ruled that ruled against the defendant. The state then, the city had 30 days in which to appeal, and chose not to appeal. That was in 1961, so we've been in court then for 4 years. The city election had been held.
Was Fred Gray the attorney in that?
Yeah. He was our local attorney. When he reached the Supreme Court, he was assisted by Bob Carter of the NAACP. And it just happened that my name headed the list of 12. And so that's why it was called the Negro Voters Alliance.
Now, you're still on the executive committee of the Alabama Democratic Conference, am I correct on that? And during the 60s, you played a pretty active role in Macon County politics.
Well, as I said, I worked trying to increase the number of Negro voters. Except in county and state elections, we didn't vote in the 60s. Only about less than 10 Negroes were able to vote in the municipal election. And it wasn't until 64 that we were able to elect the Negroes to public office in Macon County and Tuskegee. You see, in 60, an all-white city official was elected. And in 64, between 61 and 64, we were able to increase the number of Negroes registered to vote above 600. See, in 1957, there were about 600 whites and about 400 Negroes. But the number of Negro voters in 64 exceeded 600, maybe about 8,900, something like that. And so we were able to elect two Negroes to the city council. One to the Board of Education, one to the County Commission, two justices of the peace, were the first six Negroes elected to public office in Macon County in this century.
Are they the first six elected to public office in Alabama?
I don't think so, because there have been some in Birmingham, somewhere else. There might have been a few of them, not many.
What was the immediate impact of that?
Well, after the boycott, which we didn't call a boycott at the time, some of the whites who were in business simply moved away. And in 64, after the election of some Negroes, after some of the whites saw that the number of Negro voters exceeded the number of whites, and there was probably no likelihood of the white number of white voters ever exceeding Negro voters. They just moved away. Those who felt they could move away and succeed. Others stayed and I think took the position that they just simply withdraw from the body politic that is trying to influence elections and just make the most of it. There were a few others who decided to stay and participate with the Negroes and whatever kind of government that would be able to operate.
What was Alan Parker's role in that time?
From my point of view, he was probably the most helpful to us throughout the crisis and the most reasonable person with whom I had the opportunity to talk.
What was the period that you call the crisis?
I would say between 54 and 64, over a 10-year period. 54 mainly because of those folk who were able to read, quote, the handwriting on the wall, unquote, in the May 17, 1954 decision. See, there really was the beginning of a crackdown on efforts by Negroes to participate in the body politic in this particular area. See, I think many of the whites who've been in power realized then that with the population distribution, as it were, racial distribution, that it wouldn't be long before they would not be able to control completely the political situation. And then between that time and 57, when Engelhardt's bill was introduced, you see, there was planning on the part of the whites as to what they might be able to do. Do successfully. And so when I think some of them discovered that they probably couldn't win politically, was when they were able to convince Engelhardt to introduce his bill. That would give them some time. Now, some of the whites, I think, realized...
When you say the whites, you mean the city governmental official, or you mean somebody outside of the government?
No, within the city.
Within the city elected officials.
And citizens who were not officials. And I think they when they realized that there was hardly any likelihood to continue, for them to continue to restrict registration, because the 1957 Civil Rights Act began to give us some leverage. And when that act was passed, and when whites discovered that in it was some provision for making registration and voting easier for Negroes, the next best thing, at least for the city, was to put those Negroes who were eligible to vote outside of the city. And when that was attacked by the Negroes, by going to court, then there was introduced into the legislature a bill to abolish the county. You're probably familiar with that, and if you are, I need to go into it.
Sorry, go ahead.
And we, some Negroes, under the direction of the Tuskegee Civic Association, which was a civic organization, we appealed to the Macon County Abolition Committee, which was a committee of a state legislature, not to recommend the enactment of that proposed legislation. Mitchell and I went down and to Montgomery and presented a statement to the committee. The committee wouldn't let us sit down, made us stand up the whole time there. But we made the statement, and later, the legislature discovered, some officials in the legislature discovered, that there was not much likelihood that it would be able to abolish Macon County, because the representatives in the adjacent counties said, in essence, that they didn't want any of the Negroes in Macon County. If they were bottled up in Macon County, let them stay bottled up there. So we don't want them. And so they didn't give the legislature any encouragement. And so that bill never was passed. Well, it was never implemented. Now, I'm not sure whether it passed both houses. There was a referendum on it, there was a vote granting the authority to the legislature. That is, the majority of the voters, it granted the authority to abolish Macon County, but it was never implemented.
A constitutional referendum?
Yeah. I'm not sure whether it was in 58 that was done or not.
Do you know of any other situation in the country where, in order to get at that problem, there was an effort to abolish a county?
I don't know of any, not related to political situation. Then in 57, the first civil rights bill was in 57. The revision was in 60, and that gave us some further leverage, you see. And then there was a second revision in 64. And that provided, as you recall, for, that's what we call them. Anyway, federal officials going into counties, discovering Negro voters who had been denied the opportunity to register, to receive their certificates of registration. Federal registrars, I believe, and some other federal, in the opinion of the federal officials, these persons, Negroes, were eligible to vote, then they certified them to the boards of registrars, and they were ordered, their names were ordered placed on the rolls. See, a good many of our Negroes who had applied for certificates of registration had not been granted them, even though some of them had filled out 3, 4, 5 application forms. And so Judge Johnson, when he received the list.
These included some people who were members of the faculty at Tuskegee and who had PhDs, am I correct on that?
Chapman Wynn was one of them, a PhD from Boston University. Kroger, the Dean of the School of Education. I don't know how many, but maybe 100 or two were ordered certified by the court, by Judge Johnson. And then the Voting Rights Act of 65, this provided for illiterates, so they had the opportunity to register. So our major difficulty in Macon County was the task of getting registered. Once a Negro was registered, he didn't have any difficulty voting, which was different from the situation in several other counties, where the problem was intimidation of Negroes going to the polls. But we were not bothered with that. Our difficulty was getting registered. So I would call the critical period, 54 to 64, with the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act of 65, really being the act which provided an across-the-state leverage. See, the situation was not the same in all the counties in Alabama. But when the Voting Rights Act was passed, this then provided almost similar opportunities for Negroes throughout the state. And there was considerable increase in the opportunities for participating in the political process. Now, in some of the counties, it was a little more difficult because of the economic pressures on some Negro plantation areas, for example, where though Negroes had the opportunity to register, in some instances, if they registered, you see, they would lose their jobs, lose their credit. That was tried on some of the Negroes here in Macon County, but because of a good many of them who worked for the Institute and worked for the Veterans Hospitals, the percentage was considerably smaller than in some of the other counties, where that could be.
What was the name of the Negro political organization in Macon County?
Well,
during the 60s, that you helped develop?
Macon County Democratic Club. See, we started out in the Tuskegee Civic Association, but that was a sort of nonpartisan. What we were doing there, trying to stimulate registration and voting without regard to the party. Then in 60, along about 60, in the 60s, we got the impression that if we really wanted to exercise any significant influence in the political process, that we would probably have to do it through a political party. And at that time, the Democratic Party was the dominant party in the state. So we organized a Macon County Democratic Club, which later became a part of the state Negro Democratic Conference, one of the affiliates. And we began to support candidates who filed for participation in the primary, Democratic primary. We felt that going that route would probably be more advantageous to us than organizing a new party, such as John Cashin did, the National Democratic Party of Maryland. So we've been participating in the Democratic Party as best we could since the early 60s.
How effective do you feel that the Democratic Conference of Alabama is? The Alabama Democratic Conference?
I think it's done a fairly good job in trying to further stimulate registration and voting and to encourage block voting in some instances where it was possible to identify certain candidates on the state level who might be more favorably disposed toward the more open political process, might be disposed more toward fairness than some of the other candidates. And in some instances, I think with the more or less well, majority voting on the part of Negroes for those candidates, along with the voting of certain other candidates, and some candidates have gotten into office who might not have gotten in had the Negroes not voted in a block. And I think that some of those persons have probably functioned more effectively, or more favorable at least toward Negroes, than if some of the others had been elected.
Compared with the NAACP statewide, how would you compare the influence of the conference?
Well, conference probably has exerted a greater influence politically than the NAACP assessed, because the NAACP is supposed to be nonpartisan, and its major responsibility in the political process is getting a person to vote, and not necessarily for any particular candidate. Now, one of the committees in the conference is probably concerned with publicizing information concerning political candidates. But I don't know of the NAACP ever endorsing any particular candidate. It might have, but I'm not aware of. While the Alabama Democratic Conference has endorsed. And because of that endorsement, I think a larger percentage of Negroes have voted for the candidates endorsed and would have voted had there not been the endorsement.
The association that appointed a black elected official in terms of their impact?
Well, the only appointed ones that I know about, I think, are those in Macon County. I don't know the significance. I believe Arthur Shores was appointed when freshman on the city council of Birmingham was appointed. And the Negroes who've been appointed have been appointed mainly by Negro officials, not all of them. Now, when Keeble was mayor, he made some appointments of Negroes to certain boards. I would say that considering the political knowledge of Negroes at the time that they were elected to public office or appointed to public office, they have functioned about as well as I expected. Because as you know, what one needs to know to function effectively in a political process simply isn't in the book. And he has to get a good bit of his valuable knowledge from association with persons who are in politics. Negroes not having the opportunity to associate with political office holders prior to the time, that is to any appreciable extent, prior to the time that they were elected appointed, I think they've done a fairly good job. Now, I have not been satisfied with the functioning of some particular individual officials, but I attribute that to two things. One, probably to my difference in political philosophy from those persons, and two, because I might be limited in my knowledge and understanding of what is needed in comparison with their knowledge and understanding. There's some things which I could not have done or I would not have done if I'd been in their particular place. But whether that would have been what I would have done would have been best for or better for the community, city or county, I'm not sure.
Can we try an example of that?
Well,
like the mayor of Tuskegee?
Well, one thing he did, which I could not have done, that is publicly endorse George Wallace. Now, whether or not that was a shrewd political move, I don't know, it might have been. His endorsement might prove to be advantageous for Tuskegee and Macon County. But knowing the past of George Wallace, I could not have endorsed publicly. Now, I might have done what I could to support him, to get as much as I could out of him, but I wouldn't have endorsed him. Now, that's enough. There are two or three other things which have been done, which...
How do you think the others in Tuskegee feel about that?
Well, frankly, I don't know enough about the thinking of the voters at the present time. Because of the critical illness of my wife for the last 3 years, much of what I know about the political process is what I've read. I have participated actively outside myself. So, and I've not attended city council meetings, county commission meetings. I've not talked with the office holders to any appreciable extent. So I really don't know enough about what's going on to make any good judgment as to the efficiency of these officials, appointed or elected. There's one thing which I've not liked about, in my opinion, there's been too much bickering among the elected official, in my opinion. Now, some persons have said, well, this is necessary in order to get certain things done. Well, it might be. But some of it seemed to have been petty bickering on my part, and that time that could have been better spent than in that particular manner.
You think this
and that might be due in part to the fact that basically I'm a pacifist. That is, I just don't like brawls and public brawls.
What's been the political effect among Negroes in Alabama of the whole experience growing out of the beginning of SCLC in Montgomery and all the events growing out of that? The fact that Alabama was a state where a lot of the action took place insofar as the civil rights movement was concerned.
Well, I don't know how much SCLC was able to, how much influence it was able to exert. I understand that it had considerable influence in some counties south and west of Montgomery. Now, three or four other persons who might be in a better position to answer that question than I. Andrew Hayden up at Uniontown, and what is Marin County? And then the folk over in Green County, and in Lowndes County, and Bullock County. Now, the SCLC was stronger over there than over in this area. So, and I was not an active participant in SCLC, so I really don't know. Dallas County, Lowndes County, Wilcox County, Marion County, Butler County, counties over in the west, maybe down as far as Mobile, I don't know.
As you think back to the beginning of that critical period of 1954, did you have foreseen the changes that have occurred during that first 10 years and the second 10 years?
I'm not quite sure I understand the second part of it.
In that 20 years, from 1954 to 1974, was really the period of our book. There were some enormous changes in racial relations. And you think back to 1954, the beginning of that critical period, could you have foreseen the changes that occurred during that period between the relationship between the races?
Yeah, I think it's moved along about at the rate the rate of change about as I anticipated.
Was there
maybe I ought to say as I had hoped it would. Now there has been the area in which I suppose I have been most disappointed has been in the area of public education. The resistance to desegregation on one hand, and the floundering of the persons responsible for planning and I suppose executing the public education programs. Now, I've had some mixed feelings about some of the court decisions. That is, I think George Wallace and I agree on one thing, and that is that I'm not strongly in favor of, quote, mass busing. Unquote. Now, for whatever purpose, I just think that a great deal of money has been spent on busing, which could have been spent on improving the educational facilities in certain places and making, providing better educational opportunities, at least in the elementary school level. To the, basically, I'm in favor of community school at the elementary level, if that makes any sense.
Given a choice then between desegregated schools with busing or segregated schools without busing, you would take the segregated schools without busing.
At the elementary school level, the sixth grade down. Another reason for that, and that is that I suppose I'm concerned about young children, the time spent on the bus, concerned with the teachers being closer to the parents, children in that school level. So, but now, if the busing were eliminated, I'd want whatever money was spent for busing to go to the improvement of the school. Now, if it's a choice between busing and good schools, if the only way we could get good school, get it through busing, then I'd take the bus. But I don't think that it was necessary to make that alternative. That is, I don't think that was the only alternative. I think that the area in which I saw the easiest transition from rigid segregation to desegregation was in the public sector of transportation and public accommodation. Now, I may be wrong, but as I observed it in my rambling around over the South, I saw less opposition, less successful opposition in those areas and in education and in the churches, because I never would have been one to participate in the desegregation of churches, because if the God which those folk worship were their gods, as they defined it, I wanted no part of it. So I wouldn't participate in desegregation. And that's why one of the reasons why I was criticized severely here, because I wouldn't participate in the marches to desegregate the church. I'd march down to the schoolhouse, to the employment office, to the registration office, and so on. But I think my Jesus and my God just about as good as they are. If they wanted to stay in their segregated church, it's okay. But to deny me equal opportunity in education or employment, health services, I would work vigorously to increase the opportunities there. But they could have their churches.
How do you evaluate the performance of Johnny Ford as mayor?
I suppose I don't know enough about what options he had in the office. And I suppose I've been less interested in the administrative end of the government than any of the others. My major interest and study has been in the policymaking area. So I really am not in a position to appraise.
Could you assess the performance of the three legislators?
Well, the two from here, anyway.
Two from here, at least.
Well, I haven't made any attempt to compare. I know where the voters stand. I don't know whether their vote represents their judgment on performance, on promises. But during the 4-year period, I'm sure that Mr. Reed made a much greater impression on the Negro voters than Gray did, a much more favorable impression than Gray did. The reason for it, I really don't know. I was somewhat surprised as the election returned. I thought the last election primary was going to be a close race. I hadn't expected a landslide. And I wouldn't have been surprised if Reed had won in this close part, which I thought was going to be close. And here again is a good example of my not knowing the mood of the voters leading up to the primary.
Are there things we hear from both whites in Alabama as well as blacks, even outside the state? Is that George Wallace has changed. A, because he didn't use race as an issue in the 74 campaign. B, because he has support of people like Mayor Ford. Do you think he's changed?
I wouldn't trust him. This is personal. Now, I would not do anything, I don't think, to injure him, unless it's done by not voting for him. And I couldn't vote for him, I don't think, because basically I don't believe that what he has done or is doing in his so-called changed mood is the result of any conviction on his part that in the past he was wrong or he was discriminatory in his public behavior. And if there's been any change, I'm of the opinion that the change is based on the realization that if he is able to get enough votes to advance him politically, it would have to be a result of a change image. And I'd rather take my chances on somebody else. Now, you might come back with the question which some other persons have come back with, but do you believe in conversion? And I said, yes, I believe in conversion. I think some persons are converted, and Wallace might be one.
But what would it take to convince you that he had been converted? What would he have to do in terms of his public behavior to convince you that he had been converted and gone a basic attitude change?
Well, I think the main thing would be for him to admit publicly that what he had done in the past was discriminating against the Negro citizens, that the Negro citizens were entitled. A confession on his part would be necessary in order to convince me.
Mea culpa?
Beg pardon?
Mea culpa?
No. Oh, yeah.
But what do you have to do?
You think conversion requires a confession of faith? Among other things.
A confession of previous wrongdoing. See?
Suppose he made that confession. Now what would you expect him to do beyond that?
Well, two or three other things he could do. One would be to begin the appointment of persons to some of these state bodies where vacancies occur. And I'm certain he could find some persons who are capable, some Negroes who are capable of being put into those positions. I would not demand or require percentage-wise filling of these positions. I haven't believed in that. That would be one thing. Another would be his championing of certain issues and programs which would be beneficial, directly beneficial, to those who have been disadvantaged in the past, white, poor, and blacks. I believe in call them compensatory services in some area. In public health, in education, particularly. I think that it's justifiable to provide health opportunities, educational opportunities for those persons who have been previously denied equality of educational opportunities and health services. Now, I'm not in favor of employing persons who are not qualified to work on certain jobs simply to meet a quota. I would be in favor of providing supplementary or compensatory educational opportunities to those persons who are not qualified to enable them to become qualified. So I think if Mr. Wallace could do or would do something in that area, providing compensatory health services, educational services, and there's one other, I've had three of them. This would probably influence me. So, two kinds of things. One, a confession of guilt, and a move in the direction of compensating for the disadvantages, particularly in health and in education.
You're not holding your breath waiting for this?
No, because I voted against it. Now, we had a principle here in Macon County, that is those who were working closely with me, with whom I was working closely, when we started out in politics and we were voting for whites and against whites, only whites were in the campaign. If we didn't know whether the challenger was any better than the incumbent, we took the position we vote against the incumbent, we vote for the challenger, and put the incumbent out. We knew the incumbent hadn't done anything or was prejudiced or discriminated against, but if we weren't certain about the other person, we took the position, let's show the person who's on the inside.